It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Quote the exact statute. Give the notice that Congress says thou shalt give. You don't run into these problems that take place, in my opinion, because the debt collector wants to intimidate and goes, as the United States Supreme Court once said in a different context, goes perilously close to the line. And when they do that, it may be an effective way to force payment, even if a consumer is not certain that it's their debt or that the amount is correct. While that may be effective, it does not comply with the statute. If they simply, to answer your question, quote the statute, they're okay.
Consumer protection attorney and friend of the show, Dale Pittman, explains the limitations on collection letters that are imposed by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how big banks are starting to cut off the flow of cash to payday lenders. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 236, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Capital One Financial and Fifth Third Bank Corp. are terminating their account with payday lenders, the latest signs that some banks are becoming pickier about their customers in the face of stepped-up scrutiny by federal regulators. The two banks confirmed their decisions in response to questions from American Banker. Representatives of the check cashing and payday loan industries see the decisions as part of a broader trend. They're calling it bank discontinuance, in which banks are exiting businesses that they believe have fallen into disfavor with their regulators. Capital One declined to comment on whether changes in the regulatory environment contributed to its decision. On the other hand, Fifth Third said that the company's decision to stop serving payday lenders is an extension of an existing policy not to make new extensions of credit to the payday loan industry, and suggested that regulatory scrutiny was a factor in their decision. In a recent submission to a congressional committee, the Financial Service Centers of America, a trade group that represents check cashers and payday lenders, listed several banks that it says have terminated their relationships with at least one of its member companies in recent months. Besides Capital One and Fifth Third, banks on the list include Bank of America, PNC Financial Services Group, Wells Fargo, and U.S. Bancorp. Some of the banks that have been terminating these accounts are asserting that the affected companies, including state-licensed payday lenders and check cashers, present a high risk, according to Financial Service Centers of America. Before Capital One decided to stop doing business with check cashers, the firm was serving approximately half of the 150 licensed check cashing companies in New York State. The exits by Capital One and Fifth Third come as the Department of Justice has been investigating banks' relationships with online payday lenders in a probe that it calls Operation Choke Point. The Department of Justice says that it is focused on fraudsters, not legally operating companies. At the same time, federal banking agencies agencies have been stepping up their scrutiny of banks' relationships with merchants that they see as posing elevated risks because they may have a higher incidence of consumer fraud. It's unclear to what extent the trend of bank discontinuance is being driven by the specific words and actions of banking regulators, and to what extent it's the result of banks making their own judgments about the regulators' views. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here with consumer protection attorney and friend of the show, Dale Pittman, at his law office in downtown Petersburg. And we will be talking with Dale today about a case that he recently filed and had some preliminary success in the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia, dealing with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the limitations on collection letters from attorneys. Welcome back to the show, Dale.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be back.
Well, would you tell our audience, first of all, what are the underlying facts of the case that you filed?
Well, the underlying facts involved a foreclosure. This issue could relate to any kind of collection action, whether it's a foreclosure or not. But my client received a letter from a foreclosure law firm, a law firm that does nothing but foreclosure work. And the letter begins by saying that his case has been referred to them by the bank for legal action. Now, Virginia is a state in which you don't go to court if you're a creditor to bring a foreclosure. We have what is called a non-judicial foreclosure procedure in Virginia. So the letter begins with a false threat to take this person to court. The letter then goes on to tell him that he has certain rights to dispute the debt within 30 days of receiving this letter. Those rights have to be disclosed to any consumer in the first written communication that the consumer receives from a debt collector in an attempt to collect a debt. One of the things that has to be disclosed in that letter is that unless the consumer within 30 days of receiving the notice or the letter disputes the validity of the debt will be assumed to be valid by the debt collector. Now, the reason I added that extra inflection was because in this letter, the foreclosure law firm, the foreclosure mill, if you would, simply said that if you fail to dispute this debt, the amount that we're seeking to collect from you will be assumed as valid. Now, they don't say who will be doing the assuming. The notice giving the 30-day rights disclosures to the consumer has to tell the consumer that it is the debt collector who will be doing the assuming. This letter, written in the passive voice as it is, could confuse an unsophisticated consumer as to who is doing the assuming. Is it a court? Is it a credit reporting agency? Or maybe is it the debt collector?
So let's go back to the first part of that, and then we'll talk about the second part. The first part is a problem with saying that your case has been referred to us for a legal action. What precisely is wrong with calling it a case and calling it a legal action? I mean, even though Virginia is a non-judicial foreclosure state, it seems that foreclosing on someone's house would be an action that was done under the law. What was the problem with phrasing it that way?
Good question. Letters to consumers from debt collectors have to be evaluated by courts under a legal standard known as the least sophisticated consumer standard. That assumes that the person receiving the letter is an unsophisticated individual, as some courts have said, the letter is not gauged by how a federal judge or a Philadelphia lawyer would perceive the letter, but how an unsophisticated consumer, the least sophisticated consumer, someone near the bottom of the sophistication totem pole, is the way another judge has put it. And so when you say that an account has been referred for legal action to the least sophisticated consumer, that means, as the courts have pretty much universally stated, that means that a threat is being made to take a legal action. And again, in Virginia, that's not what's happening. This creditor sent this particular account, this bank sent this account to the law firm, not to bring a legal action, but to institute a non-judicial foreclosure, to call the foreclosure, if you would, on the courthouse steps, which is the way it typically takes place.
So, of course, far be it from me, or probably you, to defend collection attorneys and collection letters, but exactly how is a debt collector or a collection attorney supposed to know what to put in a letter so that it will not mislead, confuse, deceive this hypothetical yet real least sophisticated consumer?
Another good question. What the debt collector, in my opinion, should do is simply give the exact notice required by the statute. This is a simple, short, brief federal law, and if you quote the exact statute, give the notice that Congress says thou shalt give, you don't run into these problems that take place, in my opinion, because the debt collector wants to intimidate and goes, as the United States Supreme Court once said in a different context, goes perilously close to the line. And when they do that, it may be an effective way to force payment, even if a consumer is not certain that it's their debt or that the amount is correct. While that may be effective, it does not comply with the statute. If they simply, to answer your question, quote the statute, they're okay.
So when a debt collector or a collection attorney does send that first collection letter, what has to be in there? What, in your opinion, must they do to comply with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act?
Well, I won't tell you what my opinion is. I'll tell you what the statute says. They have to tell you the amount of the debt. They have to tell you, and this is all in writing, the name of the creditor to whom the debt is owed. They have to tell the consumer that unless the consumer, within 30 days of receipt of the notice, disputes the validity of the debt or any portion of the debt will be assumed to be valid by the debt collector. They have to give the consumer a statement that if the consumer notifies the debt collector in writing within the 30-day period that the debt or any portion of the debt is disputed, the debt collector will obtain verification of the debt or a copy of a judgment against the consumer, and a copy of such verification or judgment will be mailed to the consumer by the debt collector. And finally, they have to give the consumer a written statement saying that upon the consumer's written request within the 30-day period, the debt collector will provide the consumer with the name and address of the original creditor if that is different from the current creditor. That's called the 30-day validation notice. It's considered a cornerstone of the statute because the relationship here is the relationship between a debt collector and a consumer. It's not the relationship between the original creditor, let's just say Sears, and Mr. Jones or Mr. Wegbright, where the original creditor or business has a sense of maintaining goodwill within the community and a good relationship with its consumer. When the relationship shifts to that of debt collector and consumer, there is a new party who's come to the table. There's no expectation of maintaining goodwill. there could have been a mistake that was made. The consumer is going to be given under this notice 30 days to go up in the attic and find the shoebox with the old bills and see if the numbers are correct or see if this was actually their debt. They may have been out of town for 2 weeks, so the consumer's got an unfettered right to 30 days to decide whether or not to dispute the debt.
And do you find that letters, initial communications from debt buyers, that is, entities that have purchased, otherwise defaulted or written off debt, are sending correct validation letters under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, or do you find that they are also offenders?
The debt buyers are frequently offenders. Speaking generally, I would have thought after a wave of these cases like the one we're talking about today in the 90s, that you would stop seeing letter violations because the courts have created clear roadmaps as to how to comply with the law. But I see a letter violation almost every week. The debt buyers have created an industry where they go out and buy huge portfolios of stale debt for pennies on the dollar, and the game plan is to attempt to collect what we can by telephone and letter, and after that to bring lawsuits and obtain default judgments, hoping that people won't go to court so that defenses which may be available are not raised, and then they are home free after an appeal time is run to pursue that consumer for 10, 20, 30 years by garnishments, liens on property, and other methods to collect debts that may have never been valid in the first place, that may have improper charges added in, interest that shouldn't apply, amounts that are much, much bigger than earlier amounts that may or may not have been correct. And apparently the game plan is that it's simply a cost of business to pay the consumers who do file lawsuits for violations of the letter disclosure requirements and their lawyers because they're making so much money in what they're doing. The typical complaint has been, this is a complicated law. The courts are constantly imposing new requirements. That argument does not work here in the Fourth Circuit, where our conservative court of appeals has said, that's an absurd position. This is a brief, short, easy-to-understand law. If you obey its contents, you're okay. But when you don't, we're not going to protect you as a court for violating that law.
So it sounds like the real solution to this is to raise the cost of doing business so that these entities pay more attention to what they're doing and do the collection letters properly. What types of errors should consumers be on the lookout for?
In my opinion, any consumer who receives a letter from a debt collector should take the letter and the envelope and consult a competent consumer protection lawyer on the consumer side of the fence to look at the letter and discuss with the lawyer the circumstances involving the debt and the account. There may be, as in this case that we're talking about today, letter violations where it is too late for the debt collector to put the toothpaste back in the tube because they've written a bad letter. They may have written that same letter to hundreds, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, and all of those people who've received that letter may have claims under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act on a class-wide basis for failure of the debt collector to follow this simple, straightforward law.
So if a lawsuit does have to be filed against a violator of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, what type of relief is available? What type of remedies are the courts going to grant?
Well, there are largely two kinds of relief for the consumer. One is what I call statutory damages, and the other is actual damages. And on top of that, the consumer who wins the lawsuit is entitled to have her cost and attorney's fees paid. Statutory damages are damages of anywhere from $1 to $1,000 in the discretion of the court or a jury, simply available whether or not there are actual damages as a means to encourage compliance with the laws against improper debt collection. Actual damages under the statute typically involve emotional distress damages, fear of being sued, fear of physical violence, embarrassment by having a collector discuss the debt with a third party, disruption in employment, a fear of losing employment because the debt collector calls the employer, calls early in the morning or late at night. All of those things that I've listed are illegal conduct, and they're very stressful. And so when that happens, that kind of damage can be presented to a judge or a jury, and a determination can be made on what the amount of actual damages suffered by virtue of that misconduct is.
And do you find that most of your consumer clients do have those type of actual damages, those emotional distress damages that you just described?
You know, I do. And it's fascinating. One of the first cases I had, a guy was threatened based on a bad check. And he had not written the bad check. He had told the debt collector he had not written the bad check. They said, "We don't care what you say. We're going to collect our money. And if you don't pay, you're going to jail." Well, you know, I knew as a lawyer what the law was, and I knew that this guy wasn't going to jail, and I knew that he had a complete defense. This guy said to me, he said, "You know, Mr. Pittman, I was a Marine. I went through Paris Island, and I have never been as frightened in my entire life as I was when these people call and threaten me with jail time and money for something that I don't owe."
And what about the other side of the spectrum, maybe the more sophisticated consumer who realizes that this is bluster, that it's a false threat, and may not have been deceived or misled at all? They know their rights. Can a consumer like that nevertheless recover at least statutory damages? Is there?
Absolutely. Particularly in a letter case like the one we've been discussing this afternoon, the test is not what happened to this consumer. Was this consumer actually deceived? But does the letter have the capacity to confuse or mislead the least sophisticated consumer, in which case the consumer is entitled at least to statutory damages? And, of course, on top of that, attorney's fees are available. And what happens typically is that attorney's fees can be high and substantial because the debt collectors will go and pay my friends in what I like to call tall building law firms lots and lots of money to put three or four partners and even more associates defending these cases to try to intimidate the consumer into folding the tent. When that happens, attorney's fees on both sides go up, and the consumer's attorney's fees can be through the ceiling. The courts will say that there is no proportionality requirement here. I've had courts award $80,000 or in excess of $80,000 on cases where the consumer recovered $5,000. I've had a consumer recover $1,000, and I've been awarded almost $60,000 because that's what it took to ultimately win the fight against the debt collector's very competent and capable and vigorous legal defense.
So what is your best advice to consumers who are getting these type of collection letters?
My advice to a consumer is when you receive the letter, take the letter, save it, keep the envelope, make an appointment with the lawyer, look at the letter with a lawyer to see if your rights have been violated. Beyond that, if there have been telephone calls or other contact, make sure that if there was contact with a third party, a neighbor, a relative, that you have a record of that, provide the lawyer that person's name because that person could be a witness, and take notes and remember exactly what was told to you, what kind of threats were made, and how you reacted to that. And if a family member or a coworker or a minister is aware of the fear you felt or your reaction to false threats or intimidation or abusive conduct, that you are able to make sure the lawyer knows about that, because without that information, the lawyer doesn't have the tools that he or she needs.
Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with consumer protection attorney Dale Pittman about the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and violations that can be triggered by collection letters from debt collectors or collection attorneys. Thank you so much for being on the show, Dale.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be back on. Take care.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. This show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. One of the most important documents you can ever sign is a last will and testament. Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Fletcher Cook at Greater Area Agency on Aging in Petersburg talks about wills, whether you need one, and what happens if you die without one, in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on December 19, 2012. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Regner.